Okay, well, there'll be other chances, of course. So I presumably people will continue to drift in as usual in the first few minutes, but let's get started anyway. So last time, you may recall, we talked about a bunch of various fault-tolerant constructors. They're all the pieces that we need in a complete fault-tolerant computation. So today, we're going to put those together to actually prove that they do something, that they actually improve the situation with respect to errors, that if we have an uncoded circuit with errors in it, we can make a better, more reliable circuit by coding it using these fault-tolerant gates. Yeah?
I found the question I was going to ask. You used the 15-qubit code to implement the general gate, yeah?
So that was for one specific purpose. That was for the pi over 8 ancilla state. To distill a bunch of noisy ones to get a better one.
Is this the way? That 15 qubits just seems like lots.
Yeah.
Is there a better way to do that, or is that the?
So that's actually a pretty good way. There's a couple of other distillation procedures. The best one I know of that works directly on the pi over 8 ancilla. There's some other options, there's something that uses the 5-qubit code, but doesn't kind of fit into the framework of the same argument. But it uses a weird state that you don't directly use to perform a gate, you have to go through a couple of steps.
Right.
And actually, 15-qubit code is not so bad if you use it to detect errors, because then you can tolerate 2 bad ancillas rather than just 1. So that's not so, not, that's not so awful when you get right down to it. Yeah?
Is the pi over 8 state just the I tensor R pi over 8 on the Bell state?
That's right, yeah. So these are the ancillas that you use to perform the pi over 8 with the teleportation. So actually, it also works with a slightly smaller state that works on 1 block. But I haven't shown you a construction for that. Maybe if I have time at the end of today, I will. If not, probably I won't get around to it at all. But you can look it up in the literature. Okay. So then let me get started with talking about how to put these things together. And to do that, we're going to have to start to make some more rigorous statements. So we want to make a set of assumptions that we're making about these circuits and about the error model that we're talking about, so that we can start to prove things that the fault tolerance is actually going to make things better. So let's start by thinking about the assumptions that went into the circuits that I've written down. So this first set is just going to talk about the gates themselves, assuming that everything is perfect. I mean, obviously, we're not going to assume that they're perfect because we're making fault-tolerant circuits. But this first set is just going to be about the things we need to make the circuits. And then we're going to have another set of assumptions about the errors and what kind of errors we have. Okay. So one kind of obvious assumption, if we're going to get a universal set of fault-tolerant gates, we're going to have to start with a universal set of physical gates, right? But beyond that, it's not just any universal set of physical gates that will work, right? And we need very specific gates in our fault-tolerant constructions, right? Like the Clifford group was very important. We used the Clifford group gates to create Clifford group gates. And so if we, for instance, don't have the control not gate as a fundamental gate, that's going to be a pain in the neck. So let's assume, for the moment anyway, that we have any particular set of universal gates that we want. So I of course I should put some kind of reason. I have to be within reason when I ask for a particular set of universal gates, right? I can't just ask for a gate that does, you know, whatever unitary I want on n qubits. That would be kind of silly. That would ruin the whole purpose. So we're going to just fix some small number of qubits, like 2 or 3 qubits. And we're allowed to have any set of universal gates that acts on 2 or 3 qubits at a time. Okay? So in particular, for the constructions I showed you last time, it would be enough to ask for the Clifford group gates plus the pi over 8 rotation. Okay, the Clifford group gate plus the Toffoli gate. Those are two pretty good examples. Okay? And I should say that these assumptions are not going to necessarily, some of them will be necessary assumptions, most of them will not be necessary. We'll at least be able to weaken them a little bit. But for today, let's just stick with a simple set of assumptions so that we can prove something. Well, it's going to be a relatively long set, but it'll make it relatively straightforward to prove something. And the next time we can talk about to what extent these are really necessary. But some of that will be really obviously not necessary. You'll see as we write these down. Okay. So certainly we use these sets of gates already in our circuits. Another thing you may have noticed is that when we wrote down these circuits, we didn't really care about the physical location of qubits. Okay, so let's make that an assumption. Particularly, like say, we can perform gates between any set of qubits. No matter where they are in the computer. So another thing, well, of course, gates themselves are not sufficient. We also need preparation and measurement. So the next assumption will be about preparation. So in particular, there were a lot of parts of our circuits that require new ancilla qubits. So let's assume that whenever we need a new ancilla qubit, we can press a button and we'll get one. And for a lot of these circuits, it's enough to just say we have 0 ancilla qubits. But sometimes, for some other constructions, it might be nice to be able to press a button and get a different kind of ancilla qubit. That's an assumption that I'll leave up to you. At a minimum, we should be able to get 0. Okay. And of course, when we get to the second part of the second list of assumptions about errors, we're not going to assume that these ancilla qubits are perfect. They're going to have errors in them just like everything else. But we should be able to at least get them. Okay. So what about measurements? Well, obviously, we should be able to perform measurements. And again, we could imagine lots of different kinds of measurements we're not going to perform. At a minimum, we should be able to perform in the standard basis, the Z basis. And again, I'd like to say I can do this measurement whenever I want. So there's two kind of non-trivial aspects of these last two assumptions, which are maybe worth bringing forward. So the reason this is not such an obvious assumption, I mean, clearly you're not really going to be able to do quantum computation unless you can at least create some quantum states at the beginning of the computation. But actually, I'm making a stronger assumption than that, right? I'm saying that not only can I create them at the beginning of the computation, I can create them in the middle of the computation. When I need them. Okay, so physically what this would mean is you have some pool of ancilla qubits that you're constantly pooling so that they're ready to be injected into the computation whenever you need them. Okay? And again, we can talk about whether or not this is necessary later on. Similarly, this is an assumption that clearly, again, if you want to get a classical answer out, you have to be able to do some kind of measurement at the end of the computation. But I'm saying more than that. I want to be able to do it in the middle of the computation and on only certain qubits. Okay? And you remember that we use this, for instance, when we're doing error correction, we like to make measurements so that we could get a classical syncope to tell us what the error was. Okay? So these are assumptions that we've already used in the constructions of our circuits. Everybody see that? Okay. So moving on from there, this last point about measurement, perhaps makes you realize that there's another assumption that we've already used, right? Which is that when we measure things and got these classical synchrones, well, we have to do something with them. Okay, so what we've been assuming then is that classical computation is kind of outside our quantum circuit. So what that means, I guess this is partly an assumption about errors too, but let's put it here anyway. So classical computation and I guess I could say uncontrolled, because when we correct the error, we're going to do an error that we're going to do a gate that depends on what the classical bits are, right? So that's classical control. So these things are completely reliable. So we don't have to make fault-tolerant circuits that encompass the classical computation as well, okay? And more than that, let's also assume that they're fast. Okay, so now this is starting to move into a slightly different scope. Now I'm making statements about how long things take. And the reason for that is, well, the circuits didn't leave a whole lot of time for stuff waiting around. We could add that, and we're going to have to, actually, when we get right down to it. But we want to put that as a minimum. So in particular, we don't want things to have to wait around to do all this classical circuit, classical synchrone decoding. Okay? So in particular, I'm going to assume, again, simplifying assumption for the purposes of this lecture, that polynomial time classical computations actually take zero time. Okay, so obviously that's a great simplification. It's not so crazy. I mean, there's a lot of different implementations of quantum computing, and some of them are very slow compared to classical computers. So in that case, it might be reasonable, really, to approximate, you know, short classical computations as taking no time at all. Okay. Okay. Now that we start to talk about time, well, we should say something about the time to do the other things, right? So we have various different kinds of universal gates. We have state preparation, we have measurements. And in principle, all these could take different amounts of time. But as a simplification, let's make them all take the same amount of time. We're going to say all gates, preparation steps, and measurements take 1 unit of time. Okay? And then finally, I have to make since I'm talking about time, I have to make some statement about what things I can do at the same time, right? Do I have to do one gate after another, or can I do a whole bunch of them at once? So I'm going to assume I can do a lot of them at once. And in particular, I'm going to assume I can do as many of them as ones that don't actually conflict with each other. So it's maximum parallelism. So what that means concretely is that we can do any set of gates simultaneously. With a proviso, of course. And that proviso is that no two of these gates act on the same qubit at the same time.
Is this weaker or stronger than saying that provided that they commute?
Weaker than that. So certainly if they're acting on different qubits, they're going to commute, right? Because you have one set of qubits over here, one set of qubits over here. This gate is something tensor I on these qubits, and this gate is I tensor something on these qubits, right? So they'll clearly commute with each other. But there are things that commute that act on the same qubit, like controlled knot from 1 to 3 and controlled knot from 1 to 2. So they'll commute on the first qubit, but they both act on the first qubit.
So we're not saying that these could be done at the same time.
That's right. Yeah.
So then here you seem to be counting like the circuit depth only.
That's right.
Not the number of gates.
That's right, yeah.
But then...
Well, the number of gates is going to come into this. But the point is that we're going to have to... We're going to, when we get to the next set of assumptions about errors, we're going to assume errors are happening on qubits even when nothing is going on. Maybe I can get a better answer to your question in a minute once I do that. But the basic point is we're going to be counting both gates and depth are important. But it's a slightly different quantity than either. Yeah?
Isn't the proviso that they're at the same time done because all these gates take one time?
The point is you could be doing a set of gates in sequence, right? And it could be you do a single qubit gate and then you do a C0 gate and then you do a mega gate. And it could be that the C0 gate takes two times as long as a single qubit gate, right? And so qubits that are waiting around during the C0 gate would have to wait around twice as long. But the fact that we can do these all at once is, I think I see what you're saying, which is that, suppose we tried to simultaneously do a C0 gate and a Hadamard gate, and they took different amounts of time. Well, then one of them would be done first, right? So that's what you're saying. But it's kind of building on this. I mean, it could be possible that you could do them at the same time, and then one would be done first. That would be one solution. But then you'd still be doing it at the same time, right? So in that sense, it's slightly different. Other questions? So for instance, this one we've kind of implicitly already used a lot. I mean, we weren't counting time before. But like if you do a transversal gate, well, you can do all the physical gates in the transversal gate simultaneously. Right? Because they're all acting on different qubits. Okay? So it turns out actually that the circuits, the fault-tolerant circuits that we've written down, are really well suited to being parallelized. They have very low depth. Yeah.
For the state preparation, we have to prepare zero. Did we have to prepare the logical zero or just enough to prepare the zero?
So the assumption up there is physical zero.
Okay.
So I get that back down not so easily. But it's a physical zero up there. So all of these are about the physical gates. Obviously, we want to prepare logical zeros mm-hmm. too, but we have to do that through a fault-tolerant gadget.
Mm-hmm.
And same for the measurements. Yeah.
I got trouble with your number 6.
Okay.
Well, saying that any gate takes the same amount of time, isn't it a little untrue?
Well, yeah. So this is actually a problem with a lot of these assumptions, is that they're not strictly true. And like I said, these are simplifications. So this one is not actually so bad. Because, well, sure, some gates will take longer than others. At the very worst, we can kind of do a gate and then wait around a little bit. So we can, the amount of time we dedicate to that gate could always be the same. But that amount of time would have to be the longest of anything that we do. Right, so if it's a CNOT that takes longest, that sets our time scale. If it's the measurement that takes longest, that sets our time scale. Okay. This one in particular is very easy to relax if you really want to. Is that you can just set a different amount of time for each of these things, and you have to look at your circuits to make sure that all the times add up right so that things are synchronized when you need to be synchronous. But this one is definitely not necessary.
He's an experimentalist.
Yeah, well. It's also worth saying that in different implementations, the thing that takes longest varies a lot.
Yeah, because often you come across like papers that say, oh, I got to find an optimal encoding circuit for this 5-qubit code, and then you find out it's all 2-qubit beats, which at the end takes like forever to run.
Well, yeah. So in fact, our fault tolerant circuits are mostly 2-qubit gates, right? If you recall from last time, there are a lot of CNOTs. But that's because 2-qubit gates are what cause crash interference to happen. So what can you do? Okay. I mean, frequently, actually, one thing about 2-qubit gates versus 1-qubit gates is frequently you can just absorb the 1-qubit gate into the 2-qubit gates, right? I mean, it's just a matter of doing a slightly different 2-qubit gate. So, in a lot of cases, you can ignore 1-qubit gates altogether. If you want to find a minimal circuit, then you might as well say a minimal number of 2-qubit gates. But I'm not going to do that today. Okay. Other questions about this set of assumptions? Okay. So moving on, now we want to talk about errors. So actually, maybe now is a good time to almost answer Rahul's question by defining some extra terminology. So there's going to be two types of errors that I'm going to worry about. Okay, so one of them I'm going to call gate errors. And this is... gate here is kind of interpreted loosely, in the sense that a gate error is going to be an error during, well, certainly during a gate, but I'm also going to count during ancilla preparation. Well, maybe I can just call it state preparation, because it might be, you know, something that's going to become data. Or measurement. Okay. And again, these are all physical gates, state preparations, and measurements. The other type of error would be a storage error. And so storage error is an error that occurs on a qubit while it's waiting. And since I've normalized everything to take the same amount of time, we'll break up the storage errors into single time steps as well. Okay. Yeah.
So Daniel, I mean, probably you already said it, but we can sort of think of storage error as errors of identity.
That's right. That's right. So this is basically doing the identity gate. And sometimes we call this a wait step, if we're doing nothing. Yeah.
So if I'm doing C naught between 1 and 3, and mm-hmm. an error happens on 2.
That's a storage error. Well, unless we're doing another gate on 2. Okay. And so the third thing I'm going to define is a location. And so location is going to be kind of the union of all of these types of things. So it's not going to be the error itself. It's going to be a gate, state preparation, a measurement, or a weight. So the real answer to Rahul's question from before is we're not counting the gates, we're not counting the depth, we're counting the number of locations. Okay. Which is actually, so it's not quite the same as the number of qubits times the depth, because a 2-qubit gate still only counts as one location. Okay?
So you're counting...
Your question before was, it sounds like I was interested in depth when I was talking about parallelism.
Yeah.
And it turns out I'm not exactly interested in depth. And I'm not exactly interested in the number of gates in the circuit either. I'm interested in this quantity, the number of locations. We'll get to that later as to why I'm interested in that. But the point is that each location can have an error.
The reason why I said that was because you said that whenever we have all the gates at the same level, right?
Yeah.
Count it as one step.
That's right. So it's the same criterion as calculating the depth. That's right.
Yes.
But it's not because I'm interested in the depth per se.
Yeah, sure. But you're counting the complexity of that entire circuit as just the depth.
The time complexity, that's right. Time complexity is depth, that's right. That's right.
Is location things like the times the depth kind of flooded with my theory as the time?
So it's a lot like the width times the depth, except for this thing that I said, that 2-qubit gates, or for that matter, 3-qubit gates, if we have them,
yeah.
Those count as just one location.
That's just one location.
Yeah, so they're not counting, I mean, if you counted width times depth, that would be two locations,
right.
So it's a little less than that. Yeah?
So your 2-qubit gate count on one location as one location. Can they count as two error gates, or?
We're about to write down the assumptions about how these errors actually act. It's going to turn out that an error on a 2-qubit gate could affect both qubits.
Yeah.
So we don't really want to separate them as individual errors. They're really kind of one joint error. Actually, as it turns out, even errors on separate gates can act jointly sometimes. But I'll get to that later.
Yeah.
Okay. But basically, we're going to count that as just one error, the way these things are going to happen. And the motivation for that is that if you're physically doing a gate in your computer, then if that gate goes wrong, the error could affect both qubits, right? There's just one thing that has to happen that will put errors on both of those qubits. So as far as kind of the likelihood of having a problem, it's just counted as one error.
But at the end, you can say, well, the likelihood of my bit being wrong, then
At some level, we're interested in, when we have this quantum error corrected code, what's the probability of having one qubit be wrong, 2 qubits be wrong, etc. But of course, the whole idea of our fault tolerant circuits was that we didn't want to do C naughts in such a way that one C naught gate going bad would affect 2 qubits in the same block of the code. So that's what kind of gets us out of that work.
Okay. So now you're more interested in sort of your propagator more than...
That's right. So really, well, as we'll see in a little bit, we're really interested in the... Well, okay, so... Yeah, so I mean, so it's not just the propagation, because of course, even if there weren't any pre-existing errors, an error during this gate could ruin both of those. But the propagation is important too, right? Because a pre-existing error, as you say, could propagate to both of these qubits. Okay, but what we're interested in, ultimately, is the number of locations that will go wrong. And the motivation is that we've arranged our fault-tolerant circuit so that the number of locations that go wrong, so the number of qubits that are wrong in any given block, is basically the same as the number of locations that have gone wrong, or at most, is equal to at most the number of locations that have gone up. And since, you know, some amount of error correction has been done, so that's where the whole more complicated part will come in. Okay? So let's now talk about these assumptions about the errors. Okay. So so what we're going to say is that each location is going to have an error with probability p and no error with probability 1 minus p. So I'm going to separate those out for gate and storage errors. So assumption 1 will be that gate error occurs with probability p. And then with probability 1 minus p, the gate preparation or measurement acts correctly. So I assume you know what I mean by saying it acts correctly, right? A gate will do the right unitary. A measurement will project on the appropriate basis and return the classical result. And a state preparation will create an ancilla qubit in the appropriate state. Okay?
And when you say an error occurs with probability p, is there, do you have any assumption about the kind of error?
Well, I'll get to that later. Yeah.
Does a gate operate correctly if one of the qubits is wrong when it comes in?
Yeah, that's right. So the gate doesn't know what input it's supposed to get. So on an arbitrary input, it should do the appropriate unitary and take it out. Whether that's the right input or wrong input, it doesn't care about that. And similarly for measurement. Yeah?
So then the same assumption is there for identity cases?
Sorry, for any, so the same, sorry, what's the question? So the same probability for all types of gates and
including
for...
Including identity?
Well, I haven't gotten to that. These are gate errors, historic error. It is going to be the same. And the answer is yes, but I haven't, that's not included in this
okay. assumption. And then independent?
Yeah, which is even another assumption.
So you assume the same probability for all gates?
Same probability error for all gates. Again, clearly a silly simplification, but... It's a reasonable one in the sense that we can always just take the worst case error. It's the same issue as the time. Okay? So, right, so the second assumption is storage errors. Again, probability p. Probably p, storage error, probably 1 minus p, and that's it. Yeah?
I guess this implies independence then amongst the qubits.
Well, no, it doesn't. I mean, so, I mean, the way I phrased it would be kind of ambiguous if it wasn't independent. This could be that if you trace over the rest of the qubits, what is the probability of having an error just on this one? Right? And so that could be p independently, but then it could be very correlated. So, for instance, an error model where, you know, with probability p, all the qubits in the computer got flipped, and with 1 minus p, nothing happened. That would still have a marginal error probability per qubit of p. Or, if they weren't independent, I could make this be the conditional probability, conditions on other things happen. But in fact, I am about to assume that they're independent, so this is kind of a moot point. Other questions? default. I think you can tell what this one's going to say. So it's maybe worth saying that this assumption is also at the root of this whole C naught is one location thing, right? If we had the C naught be kind of two locations, if we counted an error in the C naught as two errors, then it would certainly not, I mean, it would be really lousy to say that those were independent errors, right? Because that would just be a horrible physical assumption. It just would almost never happen. Okay? But once we assume that it's one location, then this becomes a much more reasonable assumption. May not only be true, of course, but it's much more reasonable. Okay?
But, from the point of view of error correction, an error in one location could result in two erroneous qubits, physical qubits.
Well, that's right. But again, we've designed a fault-tolerant circuit, so those two qubits will be in different blocks. Okay. Right. Or in certain cases, they won't be, but will be creating an ancilla that we're then going to check, something like that. Okay. Okay. So another thing that's kind of implicit in the above description is that when a location is faulty, it's just that location that's faulty, right? The things that are not faulty, you don't have any kind of errors bleeding over to other qubits in the computer. Okay. So the next assumption is of kind of a different character.
Isn't number four kind of trivial?
No, not trivial at all. I mean, well.
So you're saying like errors only happen when errors happen?
Well, okay, yeah. So maybe it's a clarification of what I said before. But it's but underlying it, there's a physical assumption which is definitely not trivial, which is suppose you have a big computer and you do a gate on two qubits. Okay, so let's work in a limit where the storage errors, so I assume that storage errors and gate errors are pretty much the same probability. But let's work in a limit where there are no storage errors. Okay. So if you have a big computer and you do a gate on two qubits, say C naught gate between two qubits, and the rest of the qubits aren't doing anything. Okay? Well, in practice, in a lot of systems, it's actually true that doing this gate, so if we didn't do any gate at all, so there are no storage errors, there would be no errors. But doing this gate certainly can introduce errors on the qubits that are fault to the gate. But actually, in a lot of systems, it can introduce errors on some other nearby qubits as well, right? Because you're applying some control field which might bleed over to those, things like that. Mm-hmm. So we're going to simplify and assume that it doesn't happen.
It's like fire.
No, I get that, but I thought that was already ruled down by independence.
Well, arguably, yes. If you think it's redundant, I won't argue with that. Really, it was kind of implicit in the way I was describing things as separating out errors acting on gates and errors acting on waiting locations as being associated with those gates and those locations. But I think it's worth stating more explicitly. Okay? So the next one is kind of a different character. And so the other thing that I'm assuming is that when we have an error, it takes a qubit state into a qubit state. In a real system, that doesn't necessarily have to happen, right? I mean, for instance, you have ground and excited state of electron in an atom being your 0 and your 1. But there are other excited states also in this atom, right? An error might knock your electron out to one of those other excited states. Or for that matter, it might knock the atom out of the trap altogether. Okay, so let's assume that doesn't happen. maybe we shouldn't talk about qubits here. There's Q. So we have some computational Hilbert space, and we're going to remain within that.
Aren't these just erasure errors for?
Yes, these are erasure errors. That's absolutely right.
But those are easy.
Yes, also true. They're easy if you know to look for them. Okay. So in principle, you're absolutely right. So errors that take you out of the computational Hilbert space, well, that's going to be some subspace of the full Hilbert space. That's orthogonal to the computational Hilbert space, right? So in principle, you could do a measurement that says, am I in the computational Hilbert space or not? And if not, then I have to restore it somehow to the computational Hilbert space. So if the atom has left the crap, that might be actually a little difficult in some cases. But again, in principle, it can be done. You inject another atom in there. And now it's an erasure error, because you know where it is. Okay. But in practice, you don't necessarily always want to monitor for all of this. You may not have the ability to do that. And more importantly, this whole process of doing that might add extra overhead, in principle. Right? And so I'm just going to assume that's not happening. But you're right, this is not really a necessary assumption. But as I said, we'll get to that discussion next time.
This is an extremely strong statement.
A lot of these statements are pretty strong.
Maybe I get the statement wrong, but this is, for example, the two-bit joke. I don't know if it's the fault on it.
Sure.
So your zero is like three zeros in a row. Then you want to do a not gate. So let's say you're not here on the third qubit, it's a little wrong. So it maps you to 111 plus 11 and a little bit of zero.
Okay. No, that's okay. That's in the computational Hilbert space. So I'm not saying it's necessarily the code space. Right? See, errors that stayed within the code space would be very bad errors.
Yeah.
I mean that we have the 0 and 1 for each of those three bits, and we don't get anything other than 0 or 1 or superposition to 0 or 1 for the quantum condition. We don't get a 2 for the third bit. That's what I mean.
Oh, okay.
Okay? I mean, again, it's hardly any real system for which this is an accurate thing, but it's not so bad in some systems. Okay? Okay, so I have probably just enough room for this last assumption. This is a big one and more confusing. So now it's a question of what these errors actually do. Right? And so in this case, previously I've been assuming kind of best case types of things. Well, okay, the best case would be there are no errors at all. That would be a great assumption. I'd love that one. But it makes things too easy. Okay. So basically, other than that, it's been a pretty optimistic assumption. We're saying certain bad types of errors don't happen, or in this case, good types of errors. Now we're going to assume that the errors that do occur, they could be arbitrarily bad. So this is going to be an adversarial error model. So how do I want to phrase this? So the way this is going to work is we're going to flip coins. Well, we're going to imagine that if you're flipping some coins to determine where the errors are, right? Each location has an error with probability p. And then there's just going to be an adversary who's going to look at all of these locations of errors and pick the worst possible error that could occur. So I'm going to assume that the adversary is bound by the laws of physics. So the error he has to pick is going to be completely positive trace preserving, but is otherwise unrestricted. So for instance, he can do errors that interact different faulty locations. So we can describe that as collective error. And, I mean, the adversary might involve an ancilla, right? You might entangle this with an environment. You might even keep this environment around for a while. So the only restrictions are the previous assumptions. So I mean, he can't do anything that takes us out of the Hilbert space, computational Hilbert space.
Would be like a naive thing of that, just pick the location and then erase everything.
No. Well, so I mean, erase in the not technical sense of erasure errors, because he has to stay within computational space. But he can pick a location. I mean, once he's locations, he could just remove all those qubits, throw them out, and replace them with zeros, for instance. He can do that.
Would that, be the worst scenario? Or
no, worse? Not necessarily. It might be even worse than that, yeah. Because, I mean, if you replace them with zeros, you know that they're zeros.
Well, I mean, the adversary doesn't tell you anything.
So, yeah, so if that's what the adversary thinks is the worst case, the adversary is pretty good. But actually, there are situations where sometimes it's even worse actually not to have an error, right? Because we might have had an error before that we'd like to be able to detect. And so maybe the second error is occurring in our ancilla that we're using to do the synchro measurement. And it would cancel out the previous error, so we don't see the previous error. Mm-hmm. Okay? That's backwards. But anyway, the point is, so that's not a case where it's better to have no error. But that's definitely a case where you don't want to just do something random, right? You want to do something very specific to cancel out the previous error. And this would be a case where the two zeros wouldn't work. But there are also cases which I could think of if I wanted to take a minute that where actually doing no error is better, because I don't know, maybe it's then will allow something to cancel something else out, or, oh yeah, so if you just have two errors on the same qubit in a row, there's kind of no point in having an error both times, and there's a risk then of them canceling each other out. Okay, but this, yeah.
So Daniel, once you made the assumption about the errors occurring independently,
mm-hmm.
I thought that it basically means that the maps corresponding to the errors are very intense.
No, definitely does not mean that.
Yeah,
what I'm assuming here is that the probability of having a gate error on a given location or a storage error on a given location is independent from whether or not there are gate or storage errors in the other location. But once there's that error, the nature of that error is undefined. And it might actually even be no error, right? If the adversary decides that no error is the best thing to do there,
No. But what I'm saying is that, but 6 says that you can, after the locations are decided, the error could consist of a combined CPDB map on.
That's right. So the error map is not a tensor product between different things. So this is not, the errors are not independent. The error probabilities are independent. With the error probabilities meaning something slightly different than you might naively think.
But then, finally we have to describe the whole error process as a CPDB map on.
Yeah, so it's a global, well, so no, actually that's even not true. because we're allowing it, the adversary to keep an ancilla that sticks around from step to step. Right? So it might be that the adversary does something on this ancilla that entangles it with the computer. And then the next step is another thing on the same ancilla that entangles it again. And so the joint map there is a CPTV map, but the individual steps are not. If you just trace out the ancilla. Okay? So if you include the adversary's ancilla, then of course it's CPTV again. But it's also, we also don't want to assume that the errors are uncorrelated, I mean totally independent between qubits. So really what we're saying is that, so the idea of having the storage errors and the gate errors, what they do is they provide a bound on the errors. And so it's a bound that's independent, an upper bound on the error probabilities that are independent. But the actual type of errors themselves might be very highly correlated and entangled and so on. Okay. Now obviously you can assume at the physical error model that they really are uncorrelated. If you want to. But what's going to happen is that once we start to do this analysis a little more closely, we would have to prove things about this adversarial error model. So we might as well assume it from the start.
So the intention was of that P was essentially to say that the total number of locations which will have error is wrong, right?
Well, I mean, it's probabilistic, of course. But
probabilistically.
That's right, yes, that's right.
That's about it.
That's basically it, yeah. So the real assumption that we need is a little more. Is that we have far specific locations, and that the probability of having errors on all of those locations, regardless of what's going on anywhere else, is P to the R.
Yeah. I mean, to have error on R locations, probability is P to the R.
That's right. And so that's really the motivation of 133, to make sure that happens.
Okay. And the other thing is, Daniel, that, I mean, how sort of realistic the assumption is that when the error occurs, anything can happen, and when it doesn't occur, it's like a pure identity sitting there.
Oh, well,
I mean, it could be in general, like, so typically we are concerned with its distance with identity, right?
Yeah, so it's not, that's not an incredibly realistic assumption. So there's lots of types of errors that certainly don't satisfy that. But again, for today, let's just stick with this. It's a simple case that we can analyze relatively easily. And I'm not, well, we'll certainly talk next time about the more general errors. Yeah.
So I'm confused a little bit. So the adversary chooses an error on the whole config page. So that's the one that has
yeah.
to be
CPTV. Well, or at least the parts that have false on them.
Right.
But yes.
So that's the one that has to be CPTV.
Yeah, and including his ancilla, it has to be CPTV.
Right.
Because again, as I said, the ancilla could be held around from step to step.
Right. So when we pick the global locations, we mean in the whole computation. So that's
yeah.
the thing.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Once adversary or environment obtains some information about the circuit or cubes, can it use its measure in another, or for example?
So let's see. So I'm assuming here that, well, for simplicity, let's say we look at the whole circuit at all times, okay, and choose locations for the whole circuit, and then the adversary gets to look at all of that. Okay, so that does that answer your question? Yeah. Other questions? This adversarial assumption is kind of subtle, and a lot of people, I think, who have not really studied fault tolerance kind of miss this. And they think that that fault tolerance only applies to uncorrelated errors, even in the simplest model. And that's really not true. Okay? So the real bound, as I said, is that the error probability will fall relatively rapidly as P to the R. And we'll discuss that again next week.
I guess the confusion comes from when you say this error is CPTP, then maybe people think that it's Markovian from one step to the next, right?
Yeah. Well. So. Okay. So. Right. That's, I mean, I think it's a little, I mean, a little more fundamental than that. They don't really understand that we're using this adversarial error model to begin with. Okay, because usually it's I mean, if you guys want to stay very quickly with the error model, it's much easier to say, oh, it's on far later. Right, rather than going through this whole thing. And, I mean, in practice, that's kind of what it boils down to. But in detail, it's not actually true.
So basically, the correlation is not just among the qubits at the same level, but also among levels.
Well, I haven't said anything about levels yet.
No, no, but okay. Because so, this adversary was keeping some ancillas, right? So, I mean, for example, like it does some error, but stores some information about the error in the ancilla. Then the next step uses the
So at this stage, you know, I haven't said really anything about how we're encoding or anything like that. Right? I mean, we know that we're using a fault-tolerant circuit, but the adversary just gets to look at this global circuit and look at all the errors on the physical locations. And he's acting directly on the physical locations, right? So what you're thinking about is concatenation, which I'll get to at the end of this lecture.
No, but all the qubits may not be available to the adversary at the end of computing. So it's
like by level you mean time steps, basically.
Yes, yes, yes.
Ah, okay, sorry. We are going to use the word level in a different context later on in the lecture, so that was confusing me. So each time step, that's another sense in which the adversary is bound by the laws of physics. Okay, he's allowed to see where the errors are going to be, but he has to act at each given time. He doesn't have time.
No, but Daniel, you said that he keeps
ancilla, that's right.
So that means he can remember what error he did at previous
time. Absolutely.
So he can correlate errors. Mm-hmm. So that's what, he's probably saying that it's not Markovian.
That's right. Absolutely. This is a non-Markovian assumption, implicitly. It's not the most general non-Markovian assumption, but it's a non-Markovian assumption. Okay? So let's move on. So we can get to that other meaning of level. Okay, so how do we make a circuit fault tolerant? Okay, well, the first thing we do, obviously, is we take each qubit in the computer and replace it by a qubit encoded in error-correcting code. And at the same time, of course, we should replace each gate and preparation and measurement. So maybe I'll just say replace each location. By the corresponding fault tolerant thing, which I'll call a gadget. I trust you can figure out the appropriate fault tolerant gadget for a weight location. Any guesses? No, never mind. transversal identity, so that's the identity. Okay. Okay, but we're not quite done. We have a big circuit, right? We replaced everything with error-correcting codes and fault-tolerant gadgets. But of course, if it's a big circuit, then if we don't do any error correction along the way, then the errors will build up. So what we want to do is insert an error correction step. Well, maybe I should be explicit. A fault-tolerant error correction step and we have to insert lots of them, of course. Now you could imagine lots of different rules for when to do it. You might say, well, we've had so many gates, let's do an error correction circuit. But let's take just the simplest rule and insert them everywhere we can, basically. So we're going to insert it between every two locations. Or at least every pair of consecutive locations.
all blocks.
Yeah, in all blocks. So location of the number is... yeah, that's right. And part of the motivation for doing that is I want to keep everything synchronized. So if we had two weights in a row, but some other block was doing gates, right? We did some error correction here, then this wait would become longer because we'd have to wait for the duration of that error correction in order for everything to catch up. Yeah?
Isn't the fault tolerant error correction step have a bunch of boxes in it?
Yes.
Okay.
So what I mean by this is that maybe I could say more explicitly, it's consecutive locations from the original circuit. Okay. So while the error correction itself has a bunch of locations, they're not locations of the original circuit, they're locations of the new expanded circuit. Right? But that's a good distinction to make. We have locations of the original circuit, unencoded, and then we have locations now, once we've blown this up, into a fault-tolerant circuit that are physical locations of this new, bigger circuit. Okay?
Yeah. Any consecutive means?
Consecutive?
Yeah.
No, means what you think it means.
Yeah. is it like in the sequence of time or consecutive in
well, so an error correction step acts on a single block of a code, right? So it's two consecutive locations acting consecutive in time, acting on that block. Basically, maybe it's an easier way to say that, is that after each time step, each level in your terminology, we're going to do error correction on every block of the code. Okay? So what's going to happen is we're going to have an original circuit that's going to get blown up, and it's going to look like this. We do error correction, and then we do some gate, and then we do error correction again, and then we do another gate, and then we do error correction again. Remember, these thick lines are supposed to represent encoded blocks, and so on. Okay? And so what we're going to do is we're going to divide this expanded circuit up into what's called extended rectangles. So an extended rectangle is going to be a single fault-tolerant gadget that corresponds to the location of the original circuit, along with the error corrections before and after. Okay. And you'll see that, well, so this is one extended rectangle, right? But so is this. This is also an extended rectangle. Okay? So extended rectangles overlap. And later on, I may get tired of writing, so I'll say X rects instead of extended rectangle with some sort of capitalization. which might be right. Okay? Okay, everyone understand the definition of an extended rectangle? It's pretty simple, I think. Okay, good. So the next definition, is a slight modification of this. So sometimes, as it happens, we are going to be interested in extended rectangles which are missing one of the error corrections in the end. So maybe it's worth saying more explicitly. So a 2-qubit gate, like a control NOT gate that interacts two blocks, is going to have 2 error corrections before it and 2 error corrections after it, right? Because it involves 2 blocks, each of which has an error correction. Everyone sees that, right? Now I'm saying that we might be interested in a case where either 1-qubit extended rectangle or a 2-qubit extended rectangle is missing one of those trailing error corrections, or maybe both of them. And of course, if we had in our gate set 3-qubit gates, then we might be missing all 3. So we're going to call these truncated. So the purpose of looking at these extended rectangles is we're going to break up this big circuit into these smaller pieces of just some fixed size. And then we'd like to say, well, there aren't too many errors happening at a given time. Right? So if we're doing error correction very frequently, if errors happen only very slowly, then the error corrections will be able to keep up with them and fix them. Whereas if we have too many errors that happen all at once, then we have a problem. Okay? So what we're going to say is that an extended rectangle. Yeah.
But we decided we're putting an error correcting step, before and after each location.
Yeah.
So there's no truncated extended rectangle then.
So at the moment, this seems mysterious to you. I'll explain it later on, why we need this. Okay, at the moment, there's no obvious reason.
No.
I agree. Okay, so again, I want to have this definition of making sure that not too many errors occur at a given time. So we'll say, an X-rect, truncated or not, is good if there aren't very many errors. Okay, so if you have an error correcting code that corrects t errors, then the good case should be if we have at most t errors within the scope of this X-rect. Okay? Yeah?
So, as of now, we have defined an X-rect to have only one location in it.
One location from the original circuit. That's right. It has lots of physical locations because we've blown this up. But
so, by T faulty locations, I mean T.
T faulty physical locations. So, when I'm talking about errors up here, I'm talking about referring to physical locations. That's kind of the only thing I can do. Okay? And, I guess you can guess the obvious definition of bad. if it contains more than two errors.
By a physical location, you mean a qubit, a physical qubit?
Well, no, I mean location. So again, if you have a two-qubit gate within this X-rec, that two-qubit gate counts as a single location, which, even though it could cause errors on two qubits. But again, you've designed things so that those two qubits won't be in the same block. Like one would be in the data block, one would be in an ancilla block, for instance.
So T is at most two for circuits with gates that have...
No, so T is the... Let me be explicit about that. T is number of errors corrected by the quantum error correcting code. Okay, remember that our definitions of fault-tolerant circuits made explicit reference to T also. Right, we had these conditions that had to be satisfied if the total number of errors in some sum of the things was less than or equal to two. Yeah.
So Daniel, just clarifying. So in the gates which are acting parallelly, mm-hmm. you're still doing separate EC.
Sorry. So for instance, that fault-tolerant gate implementation, say it's a fault-tolerant Hadamard gate,
right.
That involves a transversal Hadamard gate, or a MUD. Say, let's think about the 7-qubit code, right? 7-qubit code, the fault-tolerant Hadamard is a transversal Hadamard. So we do a Hadamard each of the 7 physical qubits. So those are happening all simultaneously. And if one of those goes bad, that's one faulty location. And so there's one qubit that has an error. If two of them go bad, it's two faulty locations.
Yeah, no, but for the actual, not the physical location, but the original locations.
Right.
Right. In there are two locations which are parallel.
Well, yeah. So I don't know anything about what it means to have an error on a physical, on a logical location.
No. I'm saying when you transform it, right?
When
you transform it, then each of the original location you change it to a gadget. Right?
That's right.
And then, but there might be two gadgets in parallel because.
Sure.
Right. So then you do separate error correction for the
That's
parallel
right. gadget. Right. Well, you do separate error correction on each block of the code, right? So even if the gadgets are not separate, right, it's the control not gadget that's interacting two blocks. Well, the error correction acts just on one block at a time. So maybe I should draw the... So like a C-naught extended rectangle might look something like this. You take the two input blocks, you do error correction on them, then you do some kind of C0 gadget, and then you do error correction again.
Oh, so block really just means an extended qubit.
Yeah, so each qubit gets replaced by, it's encoded in a quantum error correction code, and the block is the code, right? So it's, you know, we've got N1D code, or I guess D here is 2T plus 1. Okay, so in this case, so maybe that's something worth saying. So in this case, I'm really assuming that this error correcting code only encodes one logical qubit. You could extend all of this pretty much to cases where it had many logical qubits, but I'm not going to do that. Okay. Okay. So then let's finish by proving something. Finish the first half, anyway.
So state preparation gadget, you can't put an error correction step for that.
Yeah, you're right. So that's why I said that we're putting error corrections between each. So yeah, so since I'm drawing down here a C0 extract, so why don't I also draw a preparation X-rec. Well, since there is no thing before it, no error correction before it, it just includes the thing after. So it just looks like this. Okay? And similarly, a measurement extract, there's nothing after. So it just looks like that.
I guess I'm just trying to decipher these truncated ones.
Yeah, well, don't think too much about the truncated ones. Yeah. Like I said, meaning the purpose of that will become apparent. So what I'd like to be able to say is that a good extended rectangle, right, one that doesn't have too many errors, is going to behave, in some sense, like an unencoded gate. Okay? And to do that, I'm going to make use of this ideal decoder that I defined, well, I guess I defined it 2 lectures ago, very much. But we used it a lot last lecture. So what I want to say is that for a good extended rectangle, we have the following identities. So for gate, extended rectangle looks kind of like this, at least for 1-qubit gate. 2-qubit gate is going to be kind of similar. So suppose we have that extended rectangle, and then we were to follow it by an ideal decoder. Right? Well, that would be the same as if we put this ideal decoder all the way back here, so after this first error correction, and then did an ideal gate. Okay? So you might recognize this kind of thing as we were doing before. We're saying that here we have some operation that's supposed to implement this ideal gate, this fault-tolerant gate. And we're saying that's the same as decoding and then doing the ideal gate. Right? So this is kind of saying that this fault-tolerant gate is doing the right thing. In the same sense that some of those properties that we had before were saying. Okay? But in this sense, in this case, we're not making any explicit reference to filters, right? We're only using the ideal decoder, which is going to be helpful. Okay? So you can think about that for a little while, because I want to write up also what happens for the preparate. So the 2-qubit thing looks almost the same, except there's, you know, 2 blocks now. But I also want to write out the preparation and measurement thing, since they're slightly different. There may be the obvious analog of these, but maybe obvious in this case, for low values of obvious. It's not maybe not so obvious what the obvious analog is. So okay, so suppose we have a preparation extract, so it looks like this, right? And then we follow it by an ideal decoder. Well, now, we'd like to put this through back to the analog would be to after the first error correction, but there is no first error correction. So in fact, we just get rid of this preparation altogether. So what this is, we're going to replace it by an ideal one. What this is equal to is this. Okay? And then measurement extract looks like this. And so this is different because there's nowhere to put an ideal decoder after it. But what this statement is going to be is that we can introduce an ideal decoder into here. So this is going to be equal to doing the error correction, and then doing the ideal decoder, and then doing an ideal measurement. Okay? And so these three properties, I'm going to refer to as correctness. So an extended rectangle that satisfies the appropriate property here is going to be called correct. And what this theorem is saying, and I'm going to prove it in a minute, is that a good extended rectangle is correct. And all of these can be interpreted again as saying that, well, correct, the idea of correct is that the fault tolerant gates do the correct thing. That's the name. Okay? Everyone understands this statement. Okay, so let's prove it. See if I need a second blackboard for this.
Then, for the very first one, doesn't the ideal decoder have an error correction in it?
Yes, it does. Oh, so yeah, okay. So these things are good, but they're not perfect, right? So they might have errors. So in particular, this error correction cycle might have an error in it. So in some sense, it's redundant with this ideal decoder, but it's important because it was actually in the original circuit.
I'm actually talking about the right-hand side, but...
the right-hand side.
But I guess it's the same...
So the question is, why do we have to have this? Why not push it back through?
Right.
And the reason for this... Okay, so these properties don't make any explicit reference to the filter, right? So the input state over here could be anything at all. Right? And, certainly this good extended rectangle could have an error, physical error in it. But if there was already an error on the state coming in, and we had an error again right away before we have a chance really to get into the error correction cycle, and the code only corrects one error, then that's too many. Okay? So the fact that there aren't still errors over here, that's important, because the error here and the error here could collude to cause a logical error before we even get around to this. So in this case, we're not interested in the error correction part of this. We're interested in the error part of it. Okay? And maybe that's something worth being more explicit about. So there's lots of errors here on the left, and the part of the gadget that's still left on the right still has those errors. The part that is gone, like this gate and this error correction, well, those errors are gone also. Okay? But the other ones map over one for one. And then these things are supposed to be equal as CPTP maps.
So instead, if you'd use those projectors, what are they, the R projectors?
Yes.
You could have equivalently stated this in terms with that.
Well, you could have stated something similar. And in fact, I'm going to use the filters to prove these things, which is why I needed them in the first place.
So I don't know if this is what Ashwin meant, but can you replace the error correction box by filters here on the left-hand side?
So it'll be more obvious in the second half why I don't want to do that. But the basic idea is that, well, over here, you know, when I created this fault-tolerant circuit, there are no filters. There's also no ideal decoder, so that might seem like a problem. But there are no filters, no ideal decoders. There's only error correction gadgets, gate gadgets, preparation gadgets, measurement gadgets. Okay? And what I'd like to be able to do eventually is say, well, we have a circuit consisting of only those things, but it's still somehow equivalent to an ideal circuit. And so I have to get rid of the filters. I can't rely too much on the filters and the fault-tolerant things, because they're not really there. The other advantage of doing it this way is that these are trace-preserving, whereas if I put the filters in, it wouldn't be anymore. So it makes it a little easier to say things. And actually, if you put the filters in, the statement becomes more complicated. So, because you have to make sure the normalization gets right. I guess if you leave them in, it stays there. But OK. In any case, this is the way we do it. OK? So let's prove this. So we're going to have to use, of course, these various fault tolerance properties that I defined over the past couple lectures. So let's just do this first one, and the others will be similar. So we'll start with this. And we know there's at most T errors in this whole thing. But let's break those up into where those errors occur. So there's going to be R1 errors here, R2 errors here, and R3 errors here. And we know that R1 plus R2 plus R3 is going to be less than or equal to T. Okay? So the first thing we can do is we can say, Well, we had error correction property one, which said that after an error correction step, we could introduce a filter, right? So EC property one says that this is equal to this. This R1 error is here. And then we have a filter, which is an R1 filter, right? That's what the first property said, that error correction step would only be the state that has as many errors as the step itself. And then we have our gate, and another error correction step, and the ideal decoder. Okay?
It's gate property one, isn't it? EC.
No, this is EC property one, because I'm using it to insert after this EC a filter. But the next thing I want to do is gate property one. And gate property one said I can move this filter, so if you have a filter and then a gate, then we can insert a filter after the gate that sums the errors. Right? So it's saying the errors don't propagate too bad. So gate property one says that this is equal to EC with R1 errors, filter with R1 errors, gate with R2 errors, filter with R1 plus R2 errors, and then EC with R3 errors, and ideal decoder. Okay? And so now we want to apply EC property 2 to which remember applied to combinations that look like this. Filter, EC, ideal decoder. And what that said is that we could get rid of this EC step. Right? Because R1 plus R2 plus R3 is less than equal to T. That's also important. Okay. So, okay. So the next thing we want to do is, well, so we'd like now to apply gate property too, right? But that applied to cases where we had a filter, and then a gate, and then an ideal decoder. And we have this annoying filter in the way again. So what we're going to do, actually, is we're going to apply gate property 1 again, but we're going to apply it in reverse to get rid of that filter. And so what that gives us is an error correction step, filter, and then an ideal decoder. Okay? And then we apply gate property 2 to put this through and turn this fault tolerant gate into an ideal gate. And probably you can figure out the last step. This isn't quite what we wanted on the right-hand side, which you may not be able to see anymore. But it's not quite what we wanted on the right-hand side, again, because we have this filter in the way. And so again, to get rid of that, we apply error correction property 1 in reverse. And that is what we want. Okay, so just by applying these previous fault tolerant properties, we were able to prove this and get rid of the need for a filter. Okay? So there are questions about the proof, questions about the statement of practice. Yeah.
You can make the good implies correct a double half arrow, right? Correct implies good?
No, certainly not. So certainly there'll be arrangements of faults. So here's a trivial example. If you had a whole bunch of faults in a row on the same qubit, physical qubit, that's not likely to cause correctness to fail, right? Because error correction can still deal with that. There's only one qubit in the block that's bad, that has an error. So that would be a case where you have multiple faults. It's not really good, but it's still correct. However, it turns out that actually correctness is all we're really interested in the end. So what we can do is we can modify the definition of badness to say that anything that any arrangement of faults that leads a thing to be correct, that's good. So the definition of badness then becomes kind of moot, except as a way of organizing things. But it is important to show that you need at least t plus 1 errors to get a bad, to get, sorry, an incorrect extended record. Okay, so so let me quickly confuse you again by referring to truncated rectangles. And so for truncated, as a simple corollary of this thing, a truncated extended rectangle will also have good implies correct. Using what I hope is the obvious version of these properties for a truncated rectangle. And so the proof is very easy. It is a corollary after all. So what you can do is you can reinsert that those error correction steps that you got rid of, but you just insert ones without errors. And we can do that because error correction is involved in a ideal decoder. So doing a perfect error correct without any errors, followed by an ideal decoder, that's the same as just the ideal decoder. Right? So this is kind of an operation that does nothing, but it does put us back into the form of the previous thing, in which case we can push the ideal decoders back through and get the appropriate correctness. Okay. And again, it's not at all clear why I care about these things, but we'll get to that in the second half. Okay, so let's see. So since some people may be disappearing after the break, let me make the administrative announcements first. So first of all, there's not going to be any office hours next Monday. But it is probably a good idea for people who are taking the class for credit to talk to me, if you haven't already, about your project, right? Because it's getting to the point where we're going to have to do something about that. So it turns out a couple of people did have a problem with the April 10th date, so we'll leave the project presentations on April 3rd. So the idea here is that everyone's going to read two or three research papers about something related to everyone who's taking it for credit anyway. Read two or three papers about something related to the contents of the class, error correcting codes, fault tolerance, something like that. Write up a paper, I'm thinking, 20 to 40 page range, describing those results, what was discussed in those research papers. And then present something in class on April 3rd, which, with eight people, probably is going to come out to about a 20-minute presentation per person. Okay? And my hope is that it will be comprehensible by the rest of the class, so you'll all get to learn stuff that we didn't have time to cover in the main part of the class. But, of course, I will also be in the audience. Okay? So, and like I said, talk to me about the subject. If you have an idea, that's great, but better run it by me to make sure it's appropriate and it's enough. Okay? Or for that matter, if it's too much, then I might want to warn you all. Okay? So then we'll take a 5-minute break, and those who come back will be treated to a thrilling exposition of the threshold theorem. Those who leave will have to watch on video.